fairness issue, and I'd like to explore these options everywhere, not just in areas that already have a certain level of non-single family density.
Just from a mapping point of view, I would point out that Northeast has considerably more multifamily development or zoning than Southeast right now in the zoning map. And that is a difference between those two quadrants.
Right, but aren't there large areas of Northeast that are only single family and don't have
Irvington in particular?
Yes.
The second option that I've listed here is there are some areas, and these are the yellow areas on the map, that, and this goes back to Susan's notion of some things are policy, some are in the comp plan map, and some are zoning. The second option is already on the comp plan map as a R2.5 attached housing zone, but it's zoned R5, and so we are looking at these areas for whether any of them should be upzoned to R2.5 from their current R5 status, because the comp plan has already designated these R2.5, and many of these areas have been designated but not zoned since the 80s. And so those yellow areas there, we're looking at as the zoning map that's following the comp plan moves forward, we're making proposals around which of those areas should be upzoned. The third option, which is blue on the map, we looked at other R5 areas immediately around our centers, and in particular identified areas with alleys and existing plats that are already divided at 25-foot increments. So theoretically, those areas are well set up for attached housing kind of development because of the plats and the alleys being already in existence. We excluded areas without good services, without frequent transit. So these are only areas that have complete services, alleys already platted, and are close to centers. And so those blue areas are potentially areas to explore under that topic.
Could we then take off the potential for that in the other skinny lot areas? Is there a...
You could.
What's happening with the truth in zoning skinny lot?
That's a relationship to the single family infill project, and that connection is worth making, that you could essentially solve that problem by making it not allowed in some areas and allowing it in these specific areas or something like that. The next one...
So can I just ask, what does it mean when you say it's addressed in the comp plan policy, but not addressed in the map or the zoning code?
It means that there is policy in the comp plan that says we encourage a variety of densities around centers, but those blue areas are not yet designated for that density. They could be, and the zoning map has not yet proposed that.
Does that mean you're not recommending it and the Planning Commission isn't recommending it?
Is that...
The fourth item was something that came up from a number of folks, I think Rick Potestio being one of the more vocal proponents of this notion of parks-oriented density, which is, we talk a lot about transit-oriented and corridors, but there is a school of thought that putting multifamily abutting parks is a good family-friendly, more livable environment. We heard that testimony early on in the process, even a couple years ago, and so at that time we did some analysis and identified where some places, opportunities for that might be. We ultimately did not choose to move that idea forward, but we did that analysis. We looked at parks over 10 acres that are near transit and near services and near our centers, and came up with a half a dozen possible locations. Again, that we did not end up moving forward with, partly out of just bandwidth and only taking on so much at one time. But the idea is out there, and we've done some preliminary analysis to identify some ideas where that could occur.
I mean, I think this is a wonderful idea, with the principle being parks shouldn't be limited to rich people, and in a city place where single-family homes might only be available to rich people, then this is the way to address that.
I agree.
So this is a good one where you look at it and say, at a minimum it right now, you want us to be able to have a stronger statement as part of the policy in the comp plan, and right. Then following from that, we would work on any kind of code changes.
At a minimum, but I'd also note we just appointed a new Planning Commission member, Eli Spivak, who feels very strongly about this as well. So want him to have a whack at this.
They're in the comp plan policy column because there aren't very many explicit policies about this in the current comp plan, so it may be something that you look at as in terms of adding policy. The final one then is what's already part of the broader scope of the residential infill project, which is to consider the range of forms allowed in single family zones and whether that should be expanded. And that is not mapped because it's a broader conversation about do you just broadly allow a greater range of forms in single family areas. So that would be another strategy that you could pursue that we are looking at. There is some support for that in the policies. In the attached memo, there's some of those policies are actually identified in the pullout matrix. So you can take a look at some of those and judge for yourself as to their adequacy. So back to what I started at the beginning was the objective of this conversation was to get broad direction from you about which, if any, of these strategies you feel are appropriate. And then, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're not recommending that you immediately change the land use map on these areas, but we would like direction for policy and follow-up work.
Well, I'm certainly not conversant enough as some of my colleagues are to address each one of these, but I will say that this middle density housing is very important, and we want to make sure that we encourage it as much as possible for affordability, home ownership, all those reasons.
So where you'll see this will be when we bring through the residential infill project. All of these items, or most of these items, are being discussed there, so they will come through the Planning Commission with recommendations, and those will come to you.
What's the timeline for that?
Shifting. Right now, we're looking at potentially pulling the project into two pieces and looking at the massing and the size of structures and having that through the commission, the Planning Commission, and to council late fall and done by December. The other broader looking at middle density housing and looking at the R2.5 lots. We've started that work, but we wanted to get one part absolutely finished while Mayor Hales is here, and the rest then would follow the following spring. It's really important that, from my perspective, with a new mayor, that I have strong direction from at least two or three of you, that you want us to finish that residential infill project and get that done. Because I think there will be a bit of a tension as we try to ensure that parts of these get done. If we did the whole package together and they're very interrelated, the whole thing does not get done by December. And
yeah,
that
but
was
we'll
the
be
issue.
Funding it in this coming fiscal year budget. So, yes, the new mayor will do what they want, but hope it would be several of us hopefully will still be there to remind that this is important to us. The reason I asked about the timeline for the infill project, and I'm glad you gave us more details on that, is certainly this council ought to be able to bring something to fix the Airbnb issue before then, so that the Planning Commission doesn't have to worry about that issue.
I want to just caveat one thing you said. But
can I just do a quick PSA? Without objection. So since you're talking residential infill, I learned something very interesting the other day. You know, lead in the water is a big topic now because of Flint, Michigan. Fortunately, we don't have lead in our water, and we don't have lead pipes, so we're on the right side. It turns out, though, that infill homes built between 1970 and 1985, there's at least a chance that lead was used in soldering or in the plumbing. So we urge people to do one of three things. If you live in a house built between 1970 and 1985, flush the water before you drink it, which is a good practice anyway. Filter your water, or contact the Water Bureau, and we'll send you, at no cost, a kit so you can test your water if you have any concerns. And we do about 2,000 tests a year. We don't have a lead in the water problem. But if anyone's concerned, particularly people who live in relatively new development, 1970 to 1985, it's a bigger problem in the burbs than it is here, you might want to test it just for your peace of mind.
The one qualifier to what Susan said that I wanted to make sure is clear is that the single-family infill project currently does not have on its scope the multifamily zones and what the regulations are and where those are mapped. So some of those strategies we mentioned are not currently in that scope. There is a a multifamily project that we have a Metro grant for that we're beginning the scoping work for that would occur in the next 2 years that would follow up on some of that, looking at zoning codes. So it's not all within the single family infill, particularly the question of where the multifamily comp plan designations are is not in that.
And just to be clear, on this map, the yellow, which is number two, is some of that we are expecting that you will see in the next, by December, because that's an initiative that we'd like to take on some of that. And the rest would have to be follow-up work, at least the way we're looking at it now.
First of all, it's quite phenomenal, the number of issues that have bubbled up through the Portland plan and this, how many of them you're taking care of in real time, so I really appreciate that. And then secondly, I know the mayor and I are going to have some discussions, but I am particularly concerned about Sunnyside Burns and Buckman, where we have this really interesting mix right now and how to take care of that, and whether it's by freezing the zoning in those three neighborhoods pending some kind of a reevaluation of the zoning. You know, at the very least, we do no harm. So it's something that you and that we'll be bringing back to the rest of the council once we figure out something.
On this set of tasks?
I think we just wanted to get this conversation and judge, so if there are any other comments about the strength or weakness of either of these approaches and how we go about doing it, as Joe said, the yellow is what's most likely to come first. There is no plan to move forward on the red at this point, and there is no clear plan on the orange, but you've articulated a potential path, and the blue would require further direction from you if you wanted us to go that path.
Trade-off scenario with the blue, I think, is attractive to several of us, which is where do we think historically skinny lots have been entitled but are resulting in a bad form, and where are there places where it would actually be beneficial, and can we switch some for the others?
And by rezoning the ones where we think it's beneficial, my understanding of Randy Leonard's interpretation of state law is that we can't actually take away that lot zoning and the historical pattern, but we could require some additional standards in those areas that would make it much more difficult to do the skinny house development.
On the list of questions that you attached, the second one was, should middle housing be accommodated across wide areas of the city or through expansion of zones that already allow these housing forms? And my answer, at least, is wide areas.
The pro and con there is that, of course, wide areas gives you more variety of housing types in all neighborhoods. It potentially creates difficult to serve from a transit point of view. It's preferable to cluster or be clear about your zoning if you're working at transportation planning point of view, but those are different factors.
Okay, that's a good point. I mean, it should be you clearly look at the transportation impacts, but just but to the extent that it makes sense to do it other than in areas where it's currently allowed, I still think it's worth pursuing.
The other notion that's a potential middle ground there is not middle housing, is to look at areas surrounding centers that are single family and define some distance and create some overlays or some provisions that apply there that allow greater flexibility, but not necessary if you're miles from a center. And so we've talked about doing something like that as we do follow-up plans on specific neighborhood centers, looking at those options.
Forward. Thank you.
Okay, so the last item on the agenda today is just to update you all on where we are in working on affordable housing bonuses. And we have sort of two tracks. So this is outside of the comp plan discussion, and to the extent that this is actually zoning code changes that we are looking at. The central city set of bonuses would be part of the central city plan. update Central City 2035, and you know the schedule is to have that in front of City Council by September. And that's on the side number one, labeled Central City. This is the last of your handouts, this one-pager. And on the flip side, you'll see two, which is the mixed-use zone project. And this is the one we've talked a lot about today for a variety of reasons with the scale of building discussions primarily. And that is intended to be part of the code package to implement the comp plan that gets here by December. So we have two waves of this. In the central city, on the front side, this is just to remind you all that we're looking at an affordable housing bonus. To give the affordable housing bonus the top priority, we're proposing to structure that bonus, which allows in the central city, typically you're allowed up to 3-to-1 more floor area from a bonus. And the way we're structuring this or proposing to is that the first two, if you're going after any bonus, has to come from the affordable housing. And then after that, there are a number of options, but primarily it's the historic transfer from historic properties. That hasn't changed significantly since we last discussed it with you. We're actually publishing the discussion draft of the Central City Code by the beginning of next week. We have the first volume of the Central City Plan on the street now for discussion, draft the policy piece. In that policy piece, you'll see the policy direction that allows us to do this. And then starting next week, you'll be able to take a look at the specific code provisions with the public. Now, on the flip side is the mixed use.
Before you move on?
Yeah.
Does this package include requiring some things that now get bonuses?
Yes, in the code package, there is some of that. I don't know the full breadth of it, but the other, off the top of my head, Commissioner, but the important part of this, in addition to that, is that, you know, today there's something like 18 different bonuses, and we're taking it down to a very small set so that it's focused, gives affordable housing bonus an emphasis, and historic an emphasis.
And the reason I ask is that over time we added bonuses for things that were experimental, like bicycle parking and various things that now are, we know we have standards for. So we don't need to incent any more of that. Or if we do, we should change it. So you're looking at the wide range of bonuses. And the one that's particularly important to me is the common space for the residents in multifamily to make sure that that's required, so that there is somewhere to create community.
Okay, I'm not 100% sure the status of that one, but that's part of what the discussion draft is about, so you all can see it. When you do have your hearings on the code, you will be hearing from the development community concerned that we may have overly constrained the options because they count on some of those other options. So that'll be a healthy discussion. That'll be a healthy discussion.
Right.
And just remember the difference in the central city, rents are higher, what you can expect in returns are higher than out in the neighborhoods. The amount that you can build is higher. You can easily get the 3-to-1 bonus in most of the areas of the central city. On the flip side, as I said, when you look at the mixed use zones, it's a different situation. The value, the returns are the rents, the price per square foot are lower. And the size of building that we're comfortable with introducing into our centers and corridors is smaller, right? So the amount that you would be really wanting to bonus to allow the building to be bigger in return for public benefit is constrained by that expectation of how much, you know, we are really interested in seeing developed on those corridors and how much, you know, is aligned with community interest as well. So what we've taken a look at is how to ratchet down a little bit on what can be built in the quarter so you can bonus it back. And that's and the approach, the economic approach that we did when we studied that was similar to what we did in the central city to see how much the addition, how much return can be expected from the additional floor area that a developer could build. net that against how much it costs to provide the affordable housing bonuses, and is there still an incentive there? Can money still be made? Would someone making a development decision actually do it? And what we've discovered in the on the corridors is that currently, given rents and given construction costs, it's hard to see how we can get this to work. It worked when we looked at it a year ago, because that's when we did our first round of study on this one. And in that period, the construction costs have gone up so much that that margin has gotten so tight that we're actually, it doesn't look like it easily pencils if pencils. So what you would get, and if you're looking at the margin of how profitable, the net profit after, you know, paying for the affordable housing benefit, what you make, Commissioner. And so you have to, we believe that the development project needs to make money off of what they build as bonus to be interested in doing it. And so right now, it doesn't make you money. But here's why, too. Here's the other real confounding factor is, and if you look at this page, you can see the proposed and bonus. Really, what that's just showing you is those two little vignettes of the building are give you a sense of the scale of difference that we're talking about, what you can build by right and what you could build with a bonus. When you go to the bonus level in the corridors, you typically trip into the size of building that's going to require parking. And so that's the difference. It's the parking cost is making the profit margin not positive. So, and when you combine that with the construction cost, we found that this is a potentially workable, but right now it doesn't look like it. Now, one could still have this bonus if one wanted to construct it as a payment in lieu kind of thing. You aren't going to be able to generate enough revenue, at least currently, from these kind of projects to probably include the construction of units within the building of any scale. But you could still get funds for affordable housing if you set a price that would work with the economics of the market and have that go into your housing fund.
Just one comment. The challenge with any system that creates a perverse incentive to favor the payment in lieu versus building on site is that it works against the goal we have of building affordable housing in high opportunity areas. So we're going to have to watch that because, you know, it's nice to know we'll be potentially putting funds, money into a dedicated account that Dan can use for other purposes, but it's working against the goal of having desirable, affordable housing in high opportunity areas. That's the tension. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, what this conversation is reminding me because is that it is sort of essentially the limits of using height alone as a tool to get the affordable housing. And it's a preview of the conversation we'll be having when the legislature takes the handcuffs off and allows us to look at inclusionary housing. There, we're going to have to look at a range of tools that are flexible, including probably SDC deferrals or waivers, height, a whole host of things to create a robust enough quid pro quo to make it fly. What you're telling us is there are just some basic limitations of using height only as a way of incentivizing affordable housing.
Yeah.
Or especially.
Excuse me. Especially when you have some of these other costs that kick in. So that trade-off, the SDC or whatever thing we could trade in value, might be another way to get this all to work. And remember, one of the reasons we went after the bonus is because we could do it, and the number of tools that we have is constrained by state law and other things. Eventually, we're going to look at all of this, too, in the context of if we are able to come up with a linkage fee, how does this fit in with this? If the state allows us to have inclusionary housing, how does that fit in with all of this? And it may make this finding about the bonus in these situations less critical because we have other ways of getting there. Once again, too, all of those different things are additional costs that come out of the development pro forma, so they all are really reaching into the same pot of money. And so we would find the most efficient and effective and way to raise those resources or actually get the units built.
Were you going to say something, Eric? So I guess You know, I have a lot of, I'm very impressed with all the work that's been done, and I have a lot of respect for the level of sophistication in it. And I agree that, you know, we're going to have to calibrate this after we see what happens in Salem and, you know, if the council does adopt a linkage fee. But I just want to make sure I understand, in the mixed-use zone, so you can get 100% of the FAR bonus by doing affordable housing. And then below it says you can get up to 50% if you do a transfer from Landmarks, a plaza, open space, or a green building bonus. So I guess my concern, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I think, you know, the development community, you know, we have to work hard to get the development, the private sector engaged in this affordable housing crisis. And are we setting up an opportunity for them to simply ignore the affordable housing bonus and to, you know, do 250%, a green building and open space, which, you know, we could require the open space, we could require eco roofs. So I'm just concerned that we're allowing sort of the least path of resistance to become the norm.
Sorry to interrupt. So the what I'm representing here is sort of where the draft is right now, Commissioner. And so this, when we publish this one, and Eric is actually overseeing the team that does this, that's going to be part of this discussion. I realized when we were writing it up, it's different than we're doing it in the central city, right? In part, it reflects the process that we did with the stakeholders out in the neighborhoods versus the central city, and the openness to, or the, you know, it was the desire for, in addition to affordable housing, other kinds of public benefits. So that's just something that, you know, you all as city council and the Planning and Sustainability Commission are going to have to, you know, weigh. In the central city, we sort of clearly went after the affordable housing one.
Yeah, no, I get it in the central city, but I guess my concern is, as I just said, is that you can do 250% bonuses and avoid affordable housing altogether. And that's, you know, that is what, that'll become the norm.
We're looking at the calibration of that question, because I think your point is legitimate. In the economic modeling we're doing, we did find that what was happening, at least as we've currently structured it, is that it appears that the tendency would be to do half affordable and half one of the others. That's what gets you the maximum profit. And so we're looking at calibrating those differently, so that there's a little bit less reward for some of the ones that are, so that housing doesn't get undermined. And that is part of the question, as Joe said.
And I guess I would argue also that, you know, pursuing the 2 or 3 50% bonuses really is an enhancement to the developer. I mean, you put in open space, you do a green building, you don't do any affordability, hey, I can jack up the rents on my luxury apartments even further, because I've got amenities that I was rewarded for, and I'm not achieving the goal we want, which is affordable housing.
Well, and that's the heart of the debate that we were having even in the central city, so that makes sense. But just to clarify something, the way we did it we're proposing to do it in the neighborhoods versus the downtown says there's 100% of a bonus you can earn, but you can only ever earn half of it unless you do affordable housing. So it's not that you could put 250% together. All those other options, the most you could ever get to is 50%. But even with that, it still has the issue that you're raising, Commissioner, it still does. And then the last point that I wanted to use this particular example to make is that as we get into this type of bonus, you can just see over the course of a year, the change in construction costs really affected the viability of the bonus. So we really want housing, period, to be built, and we need to raise resources and get affordable housing built. So we're going to be needing to monitor and update that bonus, sort of the economics of that bonus, much more closely than we've ever done with bonuses in the past. We tend to set them and let them go for decades. So this one will require a system that we look at more closely.
But the hydraulics of this, and that is, whereas in the central city, the 2/3 of the bonus is going to be affordable housing, and the first 2/3 have to be.
Right. The only way to get bonus is to do affordable.
And in the neighborhoods, you're proposing that at least 50% of the bonus has to be affordable housing.
Correct.
Okay.
And it's just two different ways.
If you want to get to what was.
You can still do achieve 50% of the votes without
requiring
a stop.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Emphasize some more. This again is a project that is going to come after the current comp plan adoption. There'll be lots of community engagement, presumably with the development community, developer review advisory committee, giving advice on this. Yes,
we've been working with an advisory committee for the last 2 years on that, and we have been to the DRAC a couple times, I think.
There'll be more,
And we're going to we delayed the scheduled release of Planning Commission discussion of that so that you could get through this kind of discussion first.
Right. So, Commissioner Salzman, I wonder if you want to publicize the resolution that you're bringing in as an emergency tomorrow to make sure that everybody knows it's going to be a good process.
Yeah, that's a great setup. Thank you. We are bringing a resolution tomorrow to council that states exactly what Commissioner Fritz just said, is that if we get the ban on inclusionary housing lifted, the city will undertake rules to implement that, but we will do it in full cognizance of all the other moving parts going on here, like the FAR bonus, possible linkage fees, and we will provide all stakeholders a seat at the table in addition to our typical public hearing process in crafting, implementing language for inclusionary housing and everything else.
Joe, just one other question. In your economic analysis of developer profit piece of this analysis, are you factoring in current market realities, which is 85% of the units going online are luxury? And we are in a unique moment here where we're not actually seeing much of a spread. 85% of the new units are at the luxury end, and so I would think that has an impact on the calculation of developer profit.
In the central city, I know we did it by what you think you, on average, across a sample of projects, the return per square foot. So it would capture, if most of the market, the new market, is in the higher end, it's more dollars per square foot.
We used average rents for the, which are up to date for these studies. So to the extent that they're being pulled up by that market force, then that was partially captured.
And then what?
Average rents, though, since when? The last year, okay.
That's partly what's driving the dynamics of change here, is because both rents and construction costs have gone up, which has changed the equation a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers just tell a very striking story. 23,000 new units over the last 3+ years, less than 3% affordable by any definition, and 85% in the luxury category. So it's a uncharted territory in terms of the marketplace.
Well, see, we're building these tools for the long run, too, and so there'll be business cycles over the life of these bonuses. So it's right now, that's exactly the way it's going, and just from the press reports, Denver and Seattle are sort of hitting a different place in the supply of their apartments, and it's affecting rent. So over the time, we got to make something that works over those cycles.
And,
as well.
And the best example of that is when we made the changes to the multi-tax abatement program, we said in code it annually should be reviewed and updated to take into consideration market conditions. It operated differently during the recession. It's operating differently now during a white-hot market, and that's why it does have to be recalibrated on a regular basis.
And that was the point I was trying to make. We're getting into that same kind of approach with our bonuses now. We will need to do a similar thing.
I want to put a fine point on something Joe mentioned earlier about the parking in on the mixed-use zones outside the central city. These two diagrams, they both do have some amount of parking because they're both at a density that triggers the minimum parking. But the difference is that the top diagram that's built to the base, it has parking requirements that can be accommodated on the ground floor behind the retail, and the numbers are such that it works to not have to go subgrade or structural. When you get into the bottom thing with the bonus density, what you end up with is the number of spaces starts to exceed what you can accommodate on the ground floor. And so you have to go subterranean with your parking, which is a big price spike. And that's partly what's making it so difficult to make the bonus work.
Well, surprised at that math. We're not requiring parking for the retail.
No.
So we're only requiring
No, and so when you look at the number of units,
0.25%, right?
When you look at the number of units there, and you hit that density of that higher density, you start getting beyond what you can accommodate without doing something else, and you could start eating up the retail as another opportunity to increase parking, but that also doesn't meet our objectives.
Right, and all of this is based on a hypothetical pro forma and a typical lot size. So we're shooting for something that's representative. There's going to be a lot of variation across specifics, but even what Eric just pointed out shows that when we get deeper into this, that's another path of maybe there's variations on the parking requirements that could be done in consideration for a provision of affordable housing too. But we have to do, of course, that very carefully because parking has real impacts, and that's why we adopted it in the first place. That parking in our centers and corridors in the next generation is going to be in the context of the new parking programs that PBOT is developing. So once again, it's just like we will have a different sort of context to consider all this in.
What level of affordability, when we're talking about these bonuses for affordability, what level of affordability?
Both the the mixed-use zone and the central city assumed 80% MFI. In the central city, we assumed it was kept affordable for a period of 60 years. I'm not really sure the length of affordability in that mixed
use. That's the same. I would also mention that I think Commissioner Fish mentioned this, is that we set the bonus at 80, but there is an unstated assumption that needs to be worked out that you could layer the bonus with the multi and some of the other incentives to buy down further.
Well, the last couple multi projects that came to council were at about 80%. So Commissioner Fritz raises an excellent point. We're creating an incentive system to build housing at a level that's an important part of the overall mix of our housing inventory, but isn't where the crisis is. And I think we're at risk of taking our eye off the ball here, which is 0 to 60, and particularly at the subsidized end. And that's where the crushing need is. And we're going to structure this in a way that most developers are going to come at 80%. Nice to have. It'll allow my daughter to live in a neighborhood someday, but it isn't where the crushing need is right now in terms of the housing crisis.
Joel, for gradations, and that what I was thinking was the parking issue. If there are studies showing that people at 30% or 60% are less likely to own a car, maybe if the level of affordability is at that level, then you don't have to do as much parking, which then gets to all of the needs of the neighborhood.
Yeah. The other thing to mention is that there is I'm sorry, I lost my thought.
Right, and that's how the economics, that's the hydraulics of this as well, as the mayor put it. The deeper the level of affordability, the math of this and what the project might generate in terms of units or payment in lieu is less because that's a policy choice that we all have to make, and we can set those variables.
I was going to say is, when you do the fee in lieu, the other opportunity that you have there is you can always have the fee calculated based on 80, but then spend your money on something different, and that's a trade-off.
One thing I just wanted to note is that I'm glad to see the FAR transfer point on historic preservation landmarks and contributing resources that are seismically reinforced can transfer FAR, and just to clarify that the idea there is that people with buildings that are not seismically reinforced can get the money to reinforce them by making an agreement in advance with somebody who wants the FAR that they'll pay for the cost of the seismic reinforcement.
Other direction, questions, follow-up?
Yes, so we're available. So if you have specific questions, whether it's the middle density housing or any of these others, we're available to drop in and walk them through.
And logistically, the next session, again, Susan mentioned, is the 23rd, which will be focused on the non-conforming use question and transportation. We are also entering a slightly different phase now that all of you have disclosed your various interests on amendments to us, at least at the preliminary level. We'll be, as she mentioned, posting that, but our next milestone then is to sort of take that list and bring it towards a more specific document that has the actual language of all the amendments in it by March. And so we have that next month to work on that.
And the direction our office got was, if we have an interest in a matter but another commissioner is bringing the amendment, we don't have to have competing amendments. So we're piggybacking off of stuff that other people are filing if it's an issue of concern.
Just remember that when I have a bazillion proposals, that they're not all just mine.
Oh, we'll have less after this afternoon.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not quite a zillion commissioners.
They'll perceive it as that.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Good work.